Bing bong. I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast where I've got very special guest, two of the founders of Cloaked Wireless, which is all about protecting you from a SIM swap. I think it might be the number one attack on Bitcoiners and fraud. I mean, they're going to come and try to get you. They're going to try to come and try to steal your Bitcoin. So learn about that, the SIM swaps, and some potential other threats to you as a Bitcoiner in this episode. And remember, just ladies and gentlemen, that this is not financial advice. Everything you hear in this podcast should not be taken as financial advice. And if you haven't already, hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening. Help spread the show. Tell a friend to tell a friend. And this show is powered by the Orange Pill app. That's right. That's where I met Jeremy and his co-founder, Jonathan. We both all linked on the Orange Pill app. We went back and forth. That's how we set up the podcast. I get a lot of feedback from some of you guys on the Orange Pill app, and I absolutely love it. So hit me up there. And you can use the promo link in my bio to get 10,000 sats back whenever you sign up. So please, please do so. And are you looking for the number one spot where you can learn everything that's going on in the Bitcoin space? Well, I've got it for you. It's bitcoinnews.com. Go ahead and check them out. That they are the number one place where I do all my research and find some of the best written articles in the game. So check them out at bitcoinnews.com. And lastly, shout out to the boys at Bitcoin Racing, bitcoinracing.co. They've got their own merch out. You can use promo code GreenCandle and get some merch for yourself. All right. And that'll also save you 10% off, so don't forget to use that. All right. Now, let's get into the show. Whoosh. Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast where I've got Jeremy Hill and Jonathan of Cloaked Wireless who are going to tell us about the potential next biggest attack on Bitcoin. Not on Bitcoin the network, not on Bitcoin anything else related to that, but on you, the users. If you have a smartphone like this right here, an iPhone or an Android or something else, you have the potential to get SIM swapped. We've already seen it with big name people in the industry, with George Gammon, Jeff Booth, Mark Moss, Preston Pitts, all have been SIM swapped and have had their social medias compromised because of it. So, boys, I want to start it right off the bat. Do you think SIM swapping could be the potential attack, not on Bitcoin the network, but on the next attack on Bitcoin the users, whether it's, you know, SIM swapping to steal some private keys or SIM swapping to steal some Lightning wallets or anything like that? Do you see it as a big issue here going forward, especially in this next bull run that we've got?
Yeah, 100%. And yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest issues that we're sorry, go ahead, Jonathan.
Go ahead. As we see the prices go up, we absolutely see more people becoming targets. It's just a natural course of things. The amount of money being available increases the amount of money people are willing to spend on attacks. We've seen certain groups like Lapsus willing to spend $20,000 a week for a single individual to perform the SIM swaps for any insider who works at these companies.
Yeah, I mean, it's a massive problem because I think obviously the Bitcoin community has been targeted because, you know, here's a group of people who are very public, very, very outspoken online and social media, who clearly have Bitcoin and even in you know, the altcoin world as well. And we've seen these people be targeted over and over again by these SIM swap hackers. You know, the FTX, there was like $400 million went missing from FTX. It was a result of a SIM swap attack. And I think people just don't realize how vulnerable they are, you know, and you can say this, listen, I self-custody, you know, I don't keep anything on exchanges. But the reality is that I think most people would be astonished with how many platforms and technologies they use today that still rely on SMS or voice-based two-factor authentication. And that is the core of this problem. You know, I think we would never have had to create Cloaked Wireless if SMS-based 2FA or voice-based 2FA was abolished. If that was abolished today, you know, with the exception of I think some of the privacy benefits, but the SIM swap problem would literally disappear. But the reality is that our banks, our social media, so many of the technologies and platforms we use still rely on this outdated form of two-factor authentication.
We saw things like the ESC even got SIM swapped in the run-up to the announcement of the ETFs. Twitter account for the SEC got SIM swapped and dropped the announcement early for someone to capitalize on some trading.
Yeah, I mean, it happens all the time. And I don't think people necessarily realize it, that it's like how vulnerable you really are when you're just carrying around a phone, right? I mean, essentially, like right now, it's almost impossible to go through the day-by-day basis. Like we're connecting right now over the internet, right? I mean, we've connected through email, we've connected through DMs, like that kind of stuff. All really needs a smartphone unless you want to sit at the computer or do something else like that, you know, or connecting to a hotspot or do something else like that. So the reliance on getting onto, you know, whether it's social media or spreading information, people are listening to this probably on a smartphone, right? I mean, everybody's kind of relying on that right now. And they have all the information stored in their pocket and people just don't really realize it. So
at its root, your Gmail account, the way you authenticate with Google, it totally comes down to an SMS at the end of the day. If you lose your account or password, it will probably send an SMS to your device that it has registered. That's the likely root of security for most phones. Same with Apple.
And for maybe for like if there's folks out there who don't know about SIM swap and SIM swap attacks, I can maybe just give a high level. We always assume that I think especially within our community that it's kind of a known attack. But if there's people out there that don't know what a SIM swap attack is, the origin of the problem started when companies started using SMS-based two-factor authentication. What that is, when they send you a unique code by text to your phone, and they assume that if you have your phone, then you are authorized to reset a password on a platform. And what happened when that took place is that the security responsibilities of the platform were offloaded onto the phone company. And the phone company was never meant to be an authentication platform. The phone company was meant to be, you know, the company that gave you access to a wireless network. Right. And so because that transfer responsibility took place, what happens now is that whether it's through bribery or someone coming into a store with a fake ID or coercion or even just social engineering, someone tricks an employee of your wireless company to swap your phone number onto a new SIM on a device that they control. And so from a user perspective, this is kind of what happens. You're sitting at home, you're, you know, going through TikTok, you're doing what you normally do, everything's normal. You leave your home and you disconnect with Wi-Fi, and all of a sudden your phone doesn't work. Why does my phone work? Why don't I have no connection? Now you realize, oh, I think I've been SIM swapped, right? And so now you call your phone company, but the damage is done. Because on the hacker side, what happened is the second they were successful at swapping that number over to that device, they have a team of people who are ready and waiting. They're logging into your Facebook. They're going into your Gmail. They're contacting your family, telling your family that, hey, I'm in a bind. I need Bitcoin. Send it to this address. They're going out on all fronts all at once, changing passwords. And so, you know, it's all of a sudden it's this panic where you've got to go and try and reset passwords, block things off, get your SIM back from the phone company. And the results are devastating. Like there's a fellow, Michael Turbin, who was infamously, like, he had $38 million stolen from them as a result of a SIM swap attack. And so, you know, the results of these things are devastating. And again, I think where we really want to raise awareness is that it's that the lock's not broken. It's not there. Like it literally is not there. Princeton University did a study where they took 10 accounts from the big three, and just using information online on the first call, just using social engineering, tried to SIM swap each of the accounts. They were successful 100% of the time on the first call. So when you understand like the amount of things that are tied to this phone number and how easy it is for people to swap it, that was really what drove Jonathan and I to really focus on this as one of our first offerings for Cloak Services.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't think people like realize like how much of it, like you said, like a gateway this is to your own personal life, right? I mean, before scammers had to come up to you and kind of try to fool you in person, you know, we didn't have everything so digital, but now they don't even have to leave their houses. They can just, like you said, social engineering, whether it's an email scam, sending you some fake PDF or something like that. Like it happens on a daily basis. Like millions of people are frauded and scammed every single day. You know, I mean, you could just go search in like any payment rail company, it's seemingly, PayPal scam, even Cash App, like some of these other ones, like Venmo, all these like big rails now are subjected to scam and have to be dealing with fraud. But the thing with Bitcoin is that it's a finalized payment, right? So, I mean, that's where you need to take some personal responsibility for this. So, you know, with avoiding these SIM swaps, right? I mean, because there is no company, there's no CEO of Bitcoin that you can call and be like, hey, you know, I just sent 1 million sats over to this person, you know, that I don't know. Can I get that
refund? Yeah.
Can I get my refund? So like with Cloaked Wireless and what you guys are doing there, like how is this going to help prevent in a sense, right? You said like there's not breaking the lock or, you know, like relocking. The lock's simply not there. So take us a dive deep into the technology on like kind of how this, the intricacies of this works and how we can avoid, you know, potentially getting scammed out of some of our valuable sats here.
Yeah. So one of the things that happens is that a lot of the identifiers that someone would need to use to attack you are very, very public. If you're using iMessage or something to chat with someone already knows that you have an iCloud account. And they know the identifier and the phone number of the Optus SIM swap. There are all these leaks out there that have dumped, you know, like AT&T recently had, what was it, 38 million or 70 million even accounts details released. And that's all the hackers need to get into those accounts. It's, you know, all the personal identifying information and if they can go through that list, figure out what some high value targets are, they made it very, very easy from there.
Yeah, and when we looked at the problem, I mean, really what we realized was that 100% of the SIM swaps are the result of someone other than the owner of the account modifying that account, period, right? And so when you look at it like that, the solution was obvious. The solution is that then only the owner of the account should be able to modify the account. Now, it sounds simple, and in effect, it kind of is simple, but here's the reason why it doesn't exist on the market today. And it's the same reason you were just saying about the CEO of Bitcoin not being able to issue a refund, is that there are not many wireless companies out there that are willing to tell a customer, I'm sorry, if you've lost your key, you've lost your number. We cannot help you. And that's basically what we've done. We've taken control of where we get our wholesale feed of SMS, voice, and data, which just comes from the MNO that we purchase from, and then we control everything from there until the users, you know, using the service on their wireless. And so we control all account modifications. We control what staff can and can't do. And we've locked it down so that the only person that can modify a wireless account is the owner of that account from their dashboard after they've authenticated themselves using proven open source authentication technologies, right? And we offer different levels based on whatever, you know, technical level of comfort that the user has. But by locking it down and making it so that only the user can make those modifications, we've effectively solved the problem of SIM swap attacks.
Yeah, and I think at the end of the day too, right? I mean, you can only be so private in everybody's day, in this day and age, right? I mean, that's a big issue that Bitcoiners are seeing, right? It's like, all right, you know, if you had a Facebook account, if you had a, you know, Instagram, Twitter, even like all these different things, like there's so many ways to be manipulated, get attacked now because you just live online. So it's making it so much easier. So, you know, with kind of, I guess, like, you know, almost like using Cloak as like, a defense mechanism, right? To kind of, you know, utilize that to help, like, how do you guys see this? I guess this industry even as a whole, like kind of going forward, because I think right now, you know, like you said at the beginning, is very few people kind of see this as an issue, but it's a growing one. And I think people are starting to wake up like, oh shit, my phone, like I got, you know, they lose their phone. They're like, basically their lifeline's dead. Like, you know.
And I think you hit the nail on the head when you talk about privacy, right? And Jonathan mentioned it before, 70 million user records hacked and stolen from AT&T, right? And so I guess when you use Facebook or TikTok or Google, you expect your data to be monetized, right? You expect that you're the product, you're getting something for free, you understand that they're monetizing your use of that product. But we've kind of assumed, and it's okay, that that when we sign up for our wireless service, where the transaction is pretty clear, you know, we're paying for wireless access, you provide me with wireless access. But what's happening is these companies are hoarding your personal data. They're going out there selling it, monetizing it, finding ways to dig deeper and sell more. And so they're not just, they're monetizing your personal data in addition to selling you the wireless. And so, you know, for us, privacy is very important. You know, both Jonathan and I come from the Bitcoin community, and kind of that cypherpunk ethos. And I think for us, the idea of enabling someone to come in and get quality 5G wireless without having to provide your name, without having to go through a KYC, with the ability to just come in and leave an email and pay with Bitcoin, was something that was really important for us when we created this offering, right? Because I think that is really the idea behind offering a private and secure wireless service, is that it is both secure from SIM swap attacks, but also that you're able to use it privately and anonymously if that's what you want to do.
Jonathan, do you have anything to add on, I guess, on the privacy aspect of things?
No, I mean, there was a recent attack that came across Krebs list, and it was talking about how people were using that iMessage issue that I mentioned. So there's not really much of a defense against that. You know, you basically have to get a second SIM and use that number solely as your authenticator and for your interactions with iCloud and Apple. And that's something that, you know, it's an extra step, but it's sort of the only thing you can do to lock that down. Having a private authenticator that you just use for those contacts is really the only defense. And to not have to have that be shared in any other context and is a large burden, but it's being forced on us by these this haphazard sort of rush to use the SMS in the phone as the only real identifier that anyone has with these companies. There are some things like pass keys and so forth that Google's been pushing for a while. Apple's has only recently adopted, but that's sort of the end goal. Is you will wind up with an authenticator that's essentially just a public key, and use that. But we're still many years from that being widely deployed and the standard.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, I guess I got another question here too, right? Because obviously, you know, iPhone, you know, you get it from the store. They kind of have like the SIM card almost essentially built in at this point. But something that's become very popular over the last few years, especially since COVID, has been like the digital nomad era, right? People moving around, being able to work from wherever, right? We're coming at this interview from three different places right now, right? So with all that being said, I know very many people who utilize, you know, different phones, and then when they go to a different country, they buy a SIM card from that specific country for, you know, a few months. Now, how much more does that, or how much vulnerability does that leave you open to when you have, you know, kind of like multiple SIM cards going in and out, and kind of like the growing age of, you know, not really knowing where you're at and all that kind of thing? Like, does that, you know, open you up to more potential liability as well? Like, the more you're kind of traveling around and getting around people?
Absolutely. I mean, if you have, if you've gone and used a burner phone, or burner number for setting up your iCloud, for instance, and you forget to remove that from your account entirely, someone else might get that number allocated to them just naturally. The organizations that have these like, you know, single use SMS and, or, you know, short term use SMS, will have a pool of phone numbers, and they'll be cycling through. So they'll be handed out to someone else next week. And that's not a situation you want to wind up in. You know, odds are it's not going to be someone who's trying to attack you, but they'll wind up with access to a lot of your other systems. Especially since they, you know, so many of the financial services apps are predicated on just an SMS to that number to restore access and give you access to the funds. So having something that you're able to lock down long term is sort of critical to safety online.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the key is you know, as smartphones start allowing, you know, you can store multiple eSIMs in your phone now and activate, you know, two, sometimes three SIMs active at one time. I think what's important is that you always have one that is secure, whether it's your primary or whether it's a secondary one, but one that you know is secure that you can constantly use for any type of online ask for your phone number. You know, by doing that, you're keeping good security hygiene, at least when it comes to your online authentication.
And you can cycle the data only SIMs as often as you want, but you do need that single identifier at least.
Yeah. Now, go ahead, Jeremy.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I was going to say, like, at an absolute minimum, people should, you know, check their social media platforms, make sure that they've enacted, you know, a different type of two-factor authentication other than just SMS. I think a lot of people would be surprised when they start double-clicking on their bank and their Facebook accounts to understand how many of these things are actually still relying on SMS-based two-factor authentication for password resets.
In the past couple of years, people have really started to, some of the sites have started pushing the U2F, which then became called Passkey. And that is really starting to mature now. So if you have a YubiKey or what have you, or now the phone itself is supporting this, that's a really great way to upgrade your security in a massive way.
Yeah. No, 100%. Yeah. I mean, you guys are just like listing all these like potential attacks. And I'm just sitting here thinking like, all right, I'm on Google Chrome doing all this. Google has passwords to a lot of various things, right? They have the password manager. So somebody just gets my password to my email, you know, oh shit, here we go. Off to the races for a scammer. So, I mean, I definitely, you know, I empathize with people who have that potential problem, but, you know, from your current customers that you guys have had, or like people that, you know, have seen the need for this problem, you know, what are like, I guess, some additional measures they're using to help, you know, I guess, like kind of avoid some of these potential attacks, right? I mean, obviously SIM swap's a big issue too, right? But there's the two-factor authentication that essentially happens in almost all their passwords. Is that just kind of the magic sauce here, right? Like
that is what everyone's sort of done. There was no real, you know, industry-wide analysis of whether this was a good idea or not. It was just, you know, if you're a free hosting provider, you're providing some free service. How are you going to authenticate that someone is who they are when, you know, someone might have had to use their work email and now they're no longer at that job? So how do you authenticate them? Well, the only thing that was reliable, widespread, and didn't cost them a lot more money to be able to do was to send, like, get this person's phone number and send them some sort of message, either, you know, phone them and speak a number, or send it a text if it's in the case of at the mobile. And that really just sort of pushed the problem to someone else who wasn't actually intending to have that problem be their responsibility. You know, telcos didn't ask for this. But in practice, tech companies noticed that the only long-term reliable identifier or, you know, contact method was the phone number. People will, you know, move across the country, and because of cell phone number portability, they'll keep the number. You know, once you've got a certain number of people have that phone number, you don't want to give it up. So that works great for a lot of people. For a lot of people, it doesn't work at all. You know, if you let's say you lose your job and move across the country, you might not have bothered keeping that number. And to have the answer be you're just now completely screwed is not really palatable. But it's what the tech companies have been saying to their customers for years.
Sorry. And what's unfortunate is that it's matured from there, right? Like there has like better technology exists today. When you sign up and authenticate yourself to access your wireless account, we have three options, right? You can use TOTP, which is your Google Authenticator. You can use a YubiKey, like Jonathan was saying, the U2F technology, or even like Lightning Off, right? And so if you think about your having access to a Lightning wallet and you're able to just scan a QR code and authenticate yourself in the same way that you're signing a message using your Bitcoin key, you know, these types of authentications are so much more superior to the SMS-based or voice-based authentication that's been used in the past. And yet, you know, the predominant way of resetting passwords for most platforms today remains SMS-based two-factor authentication.
Right. And even the YubiKey system is inferior to what we have in the Bitcoin space. You know, one of the things that I was drawn to Bitcoin in the first place for was it actually presented solutions to a lot of fundamental security problems. Like key management has never really been handled well in cryptography, et cetera, in the security space. You know, people had PGP keys, et cetera. But what did you do to back it up? Put it on a flash drive, put it on what have you. There were a couple paper-based systems, but nothing like we have with the Bitcoin, you know, the metal plates that you can have your mnemonic stamped on. That's a good long-term strategy. It'll survive fires. It'll survive floods. It'll survive pretty much anything if you can keep your hands on it. And you can have a couple of copies of that made and stored in multiple safe places. That's a long-term identity protection plan. Having a couple of YubiKeys is important. If you just have one, they break. They are pretty durable, surprisingly so, but they will break if you have just, you know, you throw one of the small YubiKey ones inside of your laptop and you just leave it. Sometimes you're going to bump that and the internal traces are going to break.
Mm-hmm.
So having multiple of those, if you choose that as your authentication mechanism, is critical.
Yeah, and I mean, like we've been kind of going over here, right? I mean, like Bitcoiners have kind of gotten to the point where they're able to read through the scams in person, right? Read through the shitcoinery that goes on, read through, like, you know, Ethereum, read through some of these other, you know, alt meme coins, whatever it is. But you know, we're not all protecting our bases when it comes to the potential of SIM swaps. So I think you guys have like kind of nailed it on the head and really are solving a problem that, you know, many of us are not really thinking about, especially, you know, as we're trying to grow and develop the adoption here, especially when it comes to, you know, in-person transactions, like spending on the Lightning Network and going to spend some sats. Like that opens you up to a lot of liability by having some sats on your phone, even like in cold storage in a sense, right? I mean, if you have any sort of data stored on your phone, whether it's your private keys in a Notes app or whatever, you probably shouldn't be doing that in general, right? I mean, you should probably have it on some sort of hard plate like you guys described here already. But you brought up FTX, right? I mean, that's what happened there. There's a potential, you know, I guess, what is it? A custodian, right? I mean, there's everything kind of has that. So, you know, when it comes to, you know, these potential big exchanges, whether it's, you know, the spot ETFs that we have coming on in the United States or other things like that, you know, people think that they're protected there, right? But it's not necessarily the case, right? So is that kind of are you guys kind of like noticing that as well, where it's like you're kind of you know, whether they're Bitcoiners or whatnot, they're if they're buying it and holding it on a you know, on an exchange or buying this ETF and they're thinking, hey, you know, I got it in my Charles Schwab account or I got it in Coinbase or Binance or one of these things, like it should be fine. That, you know, it's still kind of like a, I guess almost like a missing barrier that people don't realize, like, all right, it's not just like they can take my private keys, it's like they could take all my passwords to everything.
Yeah. And then, in iCloud or with Google, those passwords are exposed on the basis of probably an SMS reset. Self-custody.
Yeah, when you talk about the threat to Bitcoiners, you know, I think what's really important is, yeah, that there is that individual side where individuals need to kind of be aware of the vulnerability. It has nothing to do with their ability to you know, detect a scam. It's something that happens behind the scenes that you're a victim and then you're a victim, you know, unless you're protecting yourself. But then there's the corporate side, right? And so when you look at FTX, you look at a lot of these shit coins that get taken out or got stolen, didn't have good hygiene. A lot of these are taking place through SIM swap attacks, right? And it's not just within the crypto or Bitcoin community, but it's across corporate America, or, you know. So if you've got an InfoSec team or a network operations team, and one of them is compromised, all of a sudden, not only is their data at risk, but your corporate data is now at risk. Your customers' data is now at risk. And so, you know, a lot of these attack vectors aren't just about going and draining the bank accounts of individuals. It's also about going in and stealing data from corporations and causing irreparable damage to companies who are vulnerable. So we're seeing a lot of uptake and interest is within Bitcoin companies and CISOs who are coming over and saying, hey, we need to talk to you about getting our teams set up with secure SIMs in order to close that vulnerability that they realize is massive and potentially a threat to the business.
Like your GoDaddy account at some point, one of the authenticators they can use to reset an account is a phone number.
So imagine your website is now in the hands of a SIM swap attack, a hacker, and doing whatever they want unless you send X amount of Bitcoin to their address.
I know. It's just, it opens you up for liability, the potential of blackmail and much more, right? So it's interesting, right? Because normally we talk about the attacks on Bitcoin itself here, right? But there's also the human element too. I mean, I always think of like, I've seen some, I'm big into like the drug documentaries and that kind of thing. So I always think of like people fooling the drug dog owner or the cops, not necessarily the dog, right? So they'll see, I know some crazy things there. Well, they'll put like, the drugs underneath like some ground beef, right? So the dog starts barking at this ground beef because there's drugs underneath it, where the cop just thinks the dog's just going for meat or something like that, right? So it's not necessarily like the dog's doing anything wrong. It's the same, right? So I think like this is just perfect to kind of protect users or anything else like that. But and we got the most protected network and blockchain that there is in the Bitcoin network as well. So I think this message should definitely resonate across that. But let's get into the juicy stuff, boys. Like, how are we feeling here? I mean, we're sitting at Bitcoin like right around 70K right now with everything still going and pumping. So how are you guys feeling about the overall Bitcoin market and like, kind of embracing yourselves into this Bitcoin ecosystem with Cloak Wireless as well?
Yeah, I can jump in. I mean, I think what's cool is when you go back, right? Like, go way back, right? And it was just a couple of, nerds, cypherpunking it out and talking hardcore cryptography in these rooms on the internet, and then all of a sudden they started to have conferences, tiny conferences, right, with like 10 guys in a hotel in New York, and then the conferences got bigger, and then there were travel agencies. And then there were like Bitcoin cruises and Bitcoin resorts, and then El Salvador, right? And now there's a Bitcoin wireless company, right? Made by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners to solve a problem that our community suffered from for a long time. And the fact that we were able to kind of navigate the FCC process and launch last month and coming up to the halving and all time highs, everything. I mean, it's just it's kind of a perfect storm, and we're super stoked to be able to have this offering now as we go into the next bull run and bull cycle. Like I'm not sure I'd buy into the 100K before the halving, but I would be astonished if it didn't happen within a month or two afterwards.
Yeah, we've never been at new all-time high before the halving, and that's just going to blow up this time. I'm really excited for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead there, Jeremy.
Oh, sorry, I was going to say that Jonathan and I started Cloak Services, which is the parent company of Cloak Wireless, about 2 years ago. And Jonathan used to work at Blockstream as the founding CSO there, and then River Financial after that. But Jonathan and I actually worked together like in 2000, so God, we're all 24 years ago, at a company called Zero Knowledge Systems, and we worked with Adam Back was working there at the time, and we were building something called the Freedom Network. It was a precursor to Tor, and it didn't end up working. Tor ended up kind of taking off as a privacy network. But one of the things that we've been really passionate about since those days is building private and secure ways for people to access the internet and connect with each other. And so that certainly influenced, you know, Cloak Wireless and starting Cloak Wireless, but it also influenced the Cloak Network, which is another product that we're building right now. And you know, when the Snowden affair came out, one of the big revelations was that Tor had been compromised. Any nation state or anyone with enough visibility on the network could ultimately de-anonymize users, select users, right? And so because of that and a whole bunch of other reasons, we really wanted to solve that problem and create a better alternative to Tor, and not just enable people to access the internet privately, but also because like more than 60% of Bitcoin nodes are hosted on top of Tor. Right, so you've got a massive part of Bitcoin's infrastructure that's relying on this network that is slowly failing and decaying. So it was kind of the combination of those things that really drove us to look at how do we solve this? How do we replace Tor with something that is truly private, truly anonymous, and properly incentivized so it doesn't suffer the same issues that the Tor network is suffering on? So that's another big project that we've been working on.
Right. And more importantly, we can solve certain problems with the Cloak Wireless as is, but some privacy attacks we can't yet solve at the level we are at. Cellular networks have a fundamental location tracking problem that's inherent to the radios they use, right? Solving that is not something that you can do with at that level by putting in a new SIM or putting in a new or running a VPN. What happens is there are certain things that are tracked on the network level. NetFlow data is resold and correlated. So if you're running through a VPN, it's trivial to correlate your inbound and outbound traffic and de-anonymize you. If you're having to have the cellular network route your traffic, you're going to have them able to identify your unique location in MeetSpace. You know, they're going to know exactly where you are. Just the signal strength to various transmitters and receivers tells you where you are. So we wanted to be able to eventually solve that. And one of the ways we get there is by building out a large-scale network of nodes that are able to route your traffic and reroute your traffic. So down the road, we'd like to be able to have all the network traffic you use as a Cloak Wireless subscriber go over that network as well. So that's sort of the end game. And then down the road, have something where operators are able to have a hosted like 5G micro cell and then route any wireless traffic that's in that vicinity through the network.
Yeah, Jeremy, you said something interesting there where 60% of Bitcoin nodes are, you know, run on Tor, which is a decaying network at this point. So, you know, is this, I know we talk about the 50% attack, right, with Bitcoin miners. Like, is this another potential attack vector, right?
We saw a huge problem last, I guess, about a year and a half ago now. Tor was under a massive DDoS, and we saw people having their Lightning channels closed en masse. And if it wasn't a direct attack on the Lightning network,
yeah,
it was an effective attack on it. Because in addition to the routes being closed, they were being closed at a time when fees were very high. So they were being closed at sort of maximal cost as well. So people were getting essentially, you know, much reduced value out of that or no value out of the channels that they had established.
Yeah, and when I make a statement like Tor is failing, right? And I think the reasons why I say that is that A, I don't think it's properly incentivized. So for people who don't know, Tor is basically you're jumping from node to node to node and then exiting the network to where you're going. And by jumping from those, you know, one to the other, the idea is that you're anonymizing yourself, and the people that host those nodes do it out of the goodness of their heart. And you know, some places take on certain liabilities by hosting a node and handling that traffic. because they're handling the traffic of someone else that's browsing through their node. And so as a result of them not being properly incentivized, there's not enough Tor nodes out there. And because the Tor network hasn't really upgraded how they anonymize their data, or you know, it's first in, first out, because of these reasons, all of a sudden it's not even anonymous anymore. And so when we look to solve it, we really wanted to address, A, we need to properly incentivize it. B, it needs to be truly anonymous. So we need to use mixed net technology. We need to have a form of if there's payments, the payments need to be done anonymously. And we need to solve the problem better than the VPN industry does today, or Tor does today. And what we've created, we believe, kind of checks all those boxes. Right? And in the simplest form, the way it works is that you would have a client, right? Which is, think of it as a VPN client. You could choose to use it for free. And that means that you're limited to people hosting nodes that are free. And there will be people out of the goodness of their hearts that do that. In which case, you know, you may have to wait a little bit longer because those will be busy. Or you can throw $3 worth of Bitcoin onto your client, right? And your client immediately exchanges that with a show me in mint. So I don't know if you've heard some of the stuff that Cali BTC is doing with Cashew and Show Me Mints, but you're basically exchanging a Satoshi for a cloaked wireless Satoshi or a cloaked SAT, right? And now you have this anonymous thing that's worth the same as a Satoshi, and you can just say, hey, I want to set my price to about $3 a month. And now you'll make micropayments with these node operators who have also said, hey, I'm happy to take your data, anonymize it, and send it along its way. For, you know, 10 sats, you know, or whatever that is. And so all of a sudden, you know, you're exchanging these anonymous tokens with them, they're anonymizing your data and passing it along, and you've got everyone who's properly incentivized and getting, you know, truly anonymous access to the internet. You know, imagine a VPN service where it doesn't say, oh, I recognize you as a VPN, right? Which happens to, you know, all these, that isn't centralized, there is no one in control, it's open source. And for us, that solves a problem. And then you look at like an $8 billion global VPN market. Like if you're going to pay $5 a month to Surfshark, or you're going to pay $3 a month for a solution that completely works, it's open source, and performs way better than, you know, the private one you're using now. So you can shift that industry over to this network, and all of a sudden anyone with an unlimited, internet connection at home and a laptop that they don't mind running a node on can make a couple extra $100 a month by reselling their unlimited internet and anonymizing people's traffic.
Well, too, and like people have like a misnomer about VPNs, I think, right? I mean, like NordVPN is like one of the more major ones. And in 2019, they hit a huge data breach, right? I mean, like, you know, a lot of these companies that are like, you know, preaching security, just at the end of the day, they have their own attacks as well. But, you know, I want to go take a step back to you about like you two guys, right? I mean, you mentioned that you've been working together for over 20 years now, not to date you too much, but, you know, you guys have been working, and then you worked with Adam Back. So tell us a little bit about the Orange Pill story. How did you guys find this magic internet money? Was it kind of having to deal with like, you know, I guess the security aspect of it, where it was that kind of the bug that struck you guys, or tell us.
That's what did it for me. You know, I've been working in computer security since about 1996. I joined a company that built one of the first vulnerability scanners. And, you know, so that product was essentially, a hacker in a box that would go out on a network, find all the vulnerabilities, and you actually try to exploit them. And so I've been working in that space for a long time. And the problems inherent there are, haven't really had any real new thinking around how you solve them. A lot of the problems are core issues with how you are going to convince someone that they have to have some sort of private key that they protect properly. And, you know, when I encountered Bitcoin, I was like, this is interesting, but moreover, if we can get people to adopt this, this solves so many problems. You know, if you have a wallet with a private key that has actual value, you will protect it. You're not going to leave your YubiKey on your keychain on your keys and just leave it on your desk when you go out for lunch. You know, if it's your wallet, you're going to bring it with you because it's important, and that can be a long-term identifier that is actually cryptographically secure. And that solves a lot of problems in computer security. Just having people actually care about the thing that they're carrying around as an identifier, because it actually has financial value to them, is most of the problem solved. And just seeing how Bitcoin has addressed things like long-term key security with the mnemonic system, that is a practical and effective way to protect yourself. There's a bunch of things to even prove that, like the key XOR stuff that has been introduced. But the fundamental technology is now actually something that you can not just hand wave about. For a long time, a lot of the solutions that people were proposing in the security space were very hand wavy. They were like, "Well, we just do this. You make a lot of copies of it, and you don't ever have them anything bad happen to them," which isn't a solution.
Yeah, 100%.
All right, Jeremy, tell us your whole story, man. What resonated with you?
So when I first got into it, so my brother was the founding CEO at Blockstream with Adam Austin Hill, and he had the first Blockstream offsite. I was invited and I was hanging out. He was with Blue Matt, and I remember at the time talking to him, and I was saying, and I distinctly remember this. I was sitting there going, "Man, I don't get Bitcoin at $230." It's not sustainable. It doesn't make sense. And him, it's okay. Like, even there's Satoshis, and even if there's not many Bitcoin left, it can sustain. And him explaining that, and it still took years before I came to the realizations that I ultimately realized about Bitcoin and understanding its uniqueness. But I was definitely blessed with having an amazing orange pill experience with some pretty awesome core devs. So yeah, very lucky.
Yeah, that's some insane stuff that you guys have been just like working on this privacy aspect of things for such a long time and kind of tied it into Bitcoin. So before I let you guys both go here, I want to get you guys some prediction as to not necessarily like a price or anything like that, but kind of how you guys see the rest of this year going for any potential like big failures. Do you guys see anything? I mean, like obviously you see the SIM swap things where it's like on a personal level, but do you see any other like kind of potential attacks maybe coming to light here about Bitcoin that you guys are a little bit worried about here going forward?
I'll say this. I'm less worried about things than anyone before. Last cycle we had all kinds of very, very scammy exchanges cropping up, and obviously that just went very poorly. A lot of people were farming out trust to people hyping, insane yields that were unsustainable. There's a lot of noise and churn in the market. It seems like we've finally gotten to a point where there's a lot more maturity around everything. The SEC's finally done the same thing and allowed the spot ETFs to come forward. It's actually looking like a fairly respectable and responsible system. I'm sure we're gonna find out that maybe one of those ETFs has been doing something sketchy with their custodianship, but it's gonna be a lot less of an issue because the market's so much bigger now. It's much better distributed than it's ever been. And, Bitcoin is the only real decentralized network there is. And people are finally realizing this. And, money is going there. It's going to where the value is.
Yeah, I don't think of it as much of a threat, but I think the trend that we're going to see this year is shitcoins on Bitcoin. And I think one of the reasons the altcoins blew up was because everyone was impatient for a certain functionality that wasn't available on Bitcoin at the time. And now that functionality is more readily there, I think we're going to see a whole bunch of these alts, who have failed miserably and there's just been scams over on Ethereum. They're going to be legitimized or feel that they're legitimized by doing the same shitcoin on Bitcoin. And I think, this recent, all this controversy with Bitcoin Magazine and them taking money from, this clearly a scam, built on Bitcoin. I think this is a trend that we're going to see more and more of. I don't necessarily see it as a threat, but I just think it's the natural evolution to what will eventually be the death of the altcoin market. But I think this is one of their death throes, is going to be trying to legitimize themselves by building on top of Bitcoin.
100%. And yeah, I mean, I could definitely see all that going on as well. But Jeremy, Jonathan, you guys have been very generous with your time, so I appreciate you coming on the podcast. Why don't you tell everybody where they could figure out more about Cloaked Wireless and what you guys are doing?
Yeah, they can go to cloakedwireless.com. You can check out plans. We created a special discount code for the show. So if you put in GC2024, you'll get 25% off your first month. And yeah, if you got questions or you're just interested about the problem or want to learn more, like, feel free to reach out. Our contact info is on the website, and we get back to people pretty quickly.
Yeah, 100%. And I'll put all that in the show notes. And yeah, we got the discount code for the first month. So that's GC2024. Be sure to use it. And yeah, protect yourself from these SIM swaps, man. I mean, it's not just an attack on Bitcoin, it's an attack on the Bitcoiners. So yeah, thank you guys so much for coming on the show and
helping solve
that many aren't really thinking about.
Yeah, thanks for having us, man.